From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we speak with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer at Moscow State University on international relations, about two items, including a very interesting want ad that was put out by the Wall Street Journal for a Moscow bureau chief. Mark, first of all, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Don. Happy to all the listeners out there in the U.S. and wherever else in the world you're listening via podcast.
It looks like it's going to be more of the same, only on steroids. We'll start with the reportage in the U.S. And I saw this morning at RT a piece that it was entitled Wall Street Journal Needs a New Moscow Bureau Chief, Only Opponents of Russia Need Apply, and featured in it is a tweet from you with this attachment of a job description. This is what the Wall Street Journal wants. So you want to talk about it?
Yeah, I noticed this this tweet from Miriam Elder. Miriam Elder is one of these Russia-watching journalists, as they call them. She's at now at BuzzFeed. That great source of cat listicles and dating advice that also pretends to do some news as well. But she was passing around a job advert for a Moscow bureau chief. And I was kind of interested because I've noticed this rotating musical chairs between the Moscow correspondents in the past couple of years, and it's really actually increased in the past few months. You go from the New York Times to the Washington Post, and the Washington Post to the Guardian, and the Wall Street Journal to the Washington Post, back in the circle around, right? You've got the idea. So I clicked and checked, and they're passing around the job advert. And really excitedly encouraging each other to apply, especially women, as Miriam Elder suggests, more women need to apply. But so I had to go and read this job advert, and it's you can find it. It's still on the Wall Street Journal's website. There's no attempt to hide this even after the news has come out. So the reaction of Western journalists to this and their reaction to the criticism being none shows you how normal this is, right? I'm going to highlight this here. So bureau chief, Moscow in Russia, job description. The Wall Street Journal is seeking an experienced and enterprising journalist to serve as Moscow's bureau chief and spearhead ambitious coverage in Russia, its economy, politics, foreign and security policies, and people. Okay, yep. The Russian story is more important than it has been in decades. Yep. No disagreement. With the country playing a much more assertive role on the world stage under President Vladimir Putin, a course that has increasingly put Moscow at odds with the U.S. and much of the West. Well, I'm not quite sure that it's not the U.S. that has been trying to play a more assertive role and interfere in Russia and China's and other people's backyards.
I would say, like, for example, if you use troop deployment as a measure of that, the tanks have been rolling towards Russia and not vice versa.
Yeah. I mean, and there's no question that U.S. troops are now stationed on Russia's border and not the other way around, and it's the U.S. that was trying to overthrow governments in Syria and Ukraine and not the other way around, and so on. Libya, and so on. All right. Let's continue on. No, we're looking for someone who can lead wide-ranging reportage. I'm not sure that's an actual word. Delving deeply into the economic underpinnings of Russian power and Mr. Putin's own grip on domestic politics.
Grip,
his iron grip.
Yeah.
Getting inside Russia's hacking complex. Not that I'm sure that anything's ever been proven there, and certainly not because the U.S. does any hacking itself, Stuxnet, Flame, anything like that. And chronicling Moscow's activities in the Middle East and elsewhere. Okay. Not so happy about Syria, I guess, being defeated there. Right. And central goal will be explicating Russia's strategic aims and exploring the country's fraught relations with the Trump administration. An American official's assertion that Moscow used a campaign of hacking and disinformation to try to sway last year's presidential election.
Well, can I ask you just in that sentence, first of all, this is something that had me scratching my head. It's not something that you highlighted, but Russia's fraught relations with the Trump administration. I don't even understand what the hell that means, because Trump is being, you know, accused of, criticized for being soft on Russia or a puppet of Russia or whatever. So what are the fraught relations they're talking about?
Well, I would assume it's because they're referencing, you know, that Trump doesn't actually have any control over his administration and that the cabal of generals in the deep state that are actually running his foreign and security policy, Mattis, McMasters, Kelly and others, that they are not very fond of, you know, Pompeo. They're not very fond. That's what I assume they
okay.
mentioned.
Okay.
Or what they want to be the fraught relations, or what the deep state has sabotaged any attempt at détente between the two countries. That could be it as well.
Okay.
I'm just guessing.
No. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Not that any of that has been proven, hacking, disinformation, but I mean, even the Washington Post just came out with a piece within the last 48 hours, which admitted that even if we accept that there was some type of Russian effort to influence the election during social media, again, not that the U.S. does. Oh, wait a minute. The U.S. and the U.K. do that. And we've seen countless reports, you know, in the Western press about it, interfere in other countries and try to sway things in Iran and elsewhere. But even the Washington Post admitted that there's no evidence that anything that Russia may or may not have done had any effect on the election whatsoever.
Right.
And in fact, it's pretty fairly unlikely. But anyway, we'll continue on. Now we get to the real juicy bit.
Yeah.
Another will be looking at Putin's role as a champion of so-called illiberal democracy.
I mean, what the hell is that? Illiberal democracy.
Who calls it illiberal democracy other than you, the Wall Street Journal,
right.
I guess? I think we've had this discussion before on democracy, liberal democracy. Liberals often conflate the ideology of liberalism with the methodology for determining the will that is democracy. It is a common liberal conceit.
Right.
And there's this framing attempt that anytime a liberal is not elected in a country, whether it's a conservative, whether it's a leftist government that, you know, that is elected, then that is not a legitimate government because it is not a liberal democracy. It is, by definition, illiberal democracy.
Or at least
or
unliberal.
Authoritarian. You know, rather, even the word conservative has disappeared from the lexicon.
Right.
We only have liberal and illiberal. Who has become a beacon for right-wing politicians across Europe and even in the U.S. A beacon. Well, I mean, I can't argue that there are some right-wing politicians in Europe and Hungary and Austria and elsewhere that they, I would consider right wing, you know, generally in the conservative sense, and they don't rabidly hate Russia. I mean, they still back sanctions against Russia and so on, but they don't rabidly hate them as much as some other countries' governments do. I can assume that's what they're talking about there.
Yeah. What about the fact, though, that when you have, say, votes on sanctions like this at the UN or discussion in the, you know, Commons about all of this, some of the strongest defenders of Russia are, in fact, the left, Maduro and, you know, Ortega, Castro, et cetera, et cetera. They're not right-wing, neo-right, neo-fascist, not by any definition, and any of these clowns that call themselves leftists that criticize those people, they're out of their minds.
Oh, but those are authoritarians, Don. They may not be right-wing, but they're also authoritarians, because anything that is not liberal democracy is Hitler.
I forgot that.
Just want to remind you.
Oh, thank you. Jesus. It's hard to need a scorecard, I mean, you know.
when Tsipras and Syriza was being elected in Greece, there were similar calls that Russia was leading a far left rebellion against
right, that's right.
Far left forces as well. That far left, far right. Well, to be fair, since it is the center triangulated right. neoliberalized right. center right and center left
right.
Imperialist as well in both the EU and the US that is so intent on exerting U.S. military force, hegemony abroad, you know, that it only makes sense that Russia reaches out to the right and left ends of the spectrums that are not in favor of that policy. So right. I guess maybe that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yep. Yeah.
Then we get to this. His traditional conservatism of blood and religion.
Sounds like blood and soil.
Amid economic uncertainty. Resonates amid economic uncertainty. I don't know what economic uncertainty they're talking about because Russia is at the exact same growth rate, 2.5% as the U.S. and the much of the EU. In fact, higher than much of the EU. So I don't know what economic uncertainty they're talking about there.
And that growth rate in the U.S. is like monster growth rate compared to the last 35 years or thereabouts.
Yeah, his traditional conservatism. Okay, first of all, Russia is a fairly socially conservative, economically statist or leftish country, and Putin largely, respects that. Right. He's pushed. I would say more. He's been pushed in that direction by the Russian people and events right. than the other way around.
Right,
but. There are many people in Russia that consider Putin to be far too liberal. Far too liberal for them. We need to point that out. And those are by far the strongest opposition forces in the country. Be that from the communists on the left, or be that from the so-called Liberal Democratic Party of Russia, soft nationalists.
Zhirinovsky types, right? Yeah, right.
They in different ways they both consider Putin to be far too liberal to right. lead the country. Right. And blood and religion. All right. Again, most of the country is far more religious than Putin is. I haven't seen that he's called for any type of Orthodox revolution across Eastern Europe or anything like that. And blood. I think they're making some kind of reference to ethnic nationalism or something there, just shows how ignorant they are of Russian politics, because there are ethnic nationalists in Russia. They're usually on the fringe. They're pretty much the equivalent of white supremacists, the far right in the U.S., and they have about as much support. They hate Putin and his government for the last 12 right. years. They actually ally politically with the liberals on the street. They did right. during Bolotnaya protests, during Putin's last election and so on. Because he is in favor of a federalized, the Russian Federation,
right.
and Russia as a, shall we say, organic multicultural government. Russia does have some 200 ethno-religious groups, some plus 200. Right. Not to mention, it's the second largest source destination of immigrants, both legal and illegal, in the world, after the U.S.
Really?
Yes, really.
So, I'm hearing the echo of the Blut und Boden of Germany, where they use this blood. Terminology and it was even predated fascism. It was from the 19th century, but the Nazis used this as a rallying point. Blood meaning the Aryan blood, and so what they're doing is kind of it's not even a subtle way of ascribing that kind of racist ideology to Russia.
Yeah, and if they had wanted to do that, they had better take a look at the putsch they supported next door in Ukraine.
Really?
To see an actual
Nazi
blood, argument, an actual
right.
bit of ethnic nationalism, right. an actual where, I mean, just again this year, it's happened every year since the Maidan was going on, but on January 1st, both in Kiev and at 50 some other locations across the country, most in Western Ukraine. There were marches, torchlit marches at night. You know, the things they aren't so crazy about in the U.S. when they happen right. in Charlottesville right. or elsewhere, and I understand perfectly why.
Right.
In honor of the genocidal Nazi, the West Ukrainian genocidal Nazi collaborator Stefan Bandera's birthday. This has been going on. It's been growing. The Kiev regime has instituted this Institute of Historical Memory, which has been attacked by actual historians all across the West for their attempting to rewrite history and portray these Banderites, the Ukrainian insurgent army, the UPA, and as some kind of anti-Soviet freedom fighters, when they were actually genocidal Nazi collaborators that right. were hip deep in the Holocaust in Ukraine, yep. and quite willingly so,
yep.
As such that even the Germans at times felt they were too brutal.
Yeah, they're put off by it, like, whoa, these guys are crazy.
Crazy. I mean, and that's saying a lot. Okay. So this is going on. They're trying to rename streets all across the country after Bandera and then lots of his other associates there. And yeah, that's where they really should be looking there. And perhaps the best line the one that ties it all together at the end here. We're looking for an accomplished candidate who can report and write major stories. We're also leading a team of other top-notch correspondents to deliver world-beating coverage of this critical story. Strong Russian language skills are a distinct advantage. Okay, so let's make this clear. Russian language skills to be the Moscow bureau chief are an advantage.
Right.
But it's not absolutely necessary as long as you tick all the other political and ideological pre-assumptions.
Right.
Not
for nothing. This is written by
necessary for this job.
This is written by the people who run a newspaper. They talk about burying the lead. That's the last sentence in it. Now, if you're going to be parsing what goes on in Russia, and you can't read Russian, what in the hell are you? And you can't speak it. So when you go out on the street and the guy goes, "Psst, tovarish, slushai," you know, you don't know what the hell he just said. What are you doing there?
As long as you are ideologically sound on these
right.
other points.
That's right. Right? That's right.
They, you know, the people that they have there can actually cover for you, I guess. You know,
right.
we in Russia, we hear all the time complaints about the Russian media not being objective enough, being too critical of the U.S., being anti-American and everything. And, I usually just laugh it off. You know, we are involved in an information war. There's no question about that to me. I have always doubted, you know, these claims. I think always we should call into question the idea of journalistic objectivity from everyone. I mean, there are always different worldviews, different national interests, different ideologies, different corporate editorial lines, you know, what have you, that constitute, you know, what you write and how. And usually any even a pretense at objectivity is just a varnish put on top of your opinions. My advice has always been to read multiple news sources from within a country, from different political perspectives, from different countries, and try to ascertain what makes sense to you. Right. They have a big problem with RT's slogan, "Question More," because that you should never question their narrative. You know, and this is exactly what this job description is. Their bias is directly built into their job descriptions,
right.
such that it actually sounds like an op-ed
yeah,
rather
right.
than
That's right. That's
a job description. And this is what it's required to become a bureau chief in Moscow. You have to believe, you know, these things, these, and some of them, which are demonstrably false, and some of them, which are very questionable.
And this is for the Wall Street Journal.
This is one of the top here. And not only that, but the other journalists in Moscow were passing this around without
right.
batting an eye.
Right,
if
right.
It's perfectly normal.
I wonder how much it pays.
To be fair, it is perfectly normal. They
right.
don't see anything wrong with it because they all have this opinion already. But
right.
at least let's do away with any idea that that Western reporters in Russia are in any way fair, objective, or balanced, you know, fair and balanced, what have you. They're not. You know, this is an information war. And as far as I'm concerned, this is just, you know, them not even being shy about advertising that fact.
So while we're talking about this, you know, kind of, let's figure out the narrative by reading the media of, you know, the countries on either side of a controversy and others. Let's go to some big event that's going to take place today for as long as it takes for Russia to veto it at the UN Security Council, where Nikki Haley is convening a hate fest, basically, directed at the government of Iran. And at Press TV's website, they point out that people have been in the streets for the third consecutive day in support of their government in the millions.
Yeah, this whole Iran protest story has gone all out of control, quite by purpose, in the Western media. As soon as they see protests in Iran, a whole lot of neocons and, quote, experts, unquote, who have no real knowledge of Iran whatsoever, crawl out of the woodwork and begin calling as one voice for regime change. And this has been ridiculous from the very beginning. By all accounts, there has never been really any more than 15,000 people in a country of tens of millions protesting against the government in these protests. And from everything that we can tell, I mean, even admitted in the Western media, these protests didn't even start as anti-government, as in anti-systemic, anti-establishment right. protests. Right. These were simple cries, you right. know, for economic address,
right.
a cries for the government to address their economic problems.
Cut the price of bread or whatever kind of thing. Exactly. Specific.
Unlike the green protests in 2009, this wasn't in Tehran. It started in the regions. It was actually the working class, working class poor of the regions outside Tehran in the country, that these were the first people who began to protest. And there is a lot of talk. I can't judge whether, you know, it's accounted. It seems to be credible and widely reported that actually the conservative forces in the country, in the government, you know, within the Iranian government, within the parliament and so on, actually supported these protests because they're not actually too happy with the current president Rouhani, who is viewed right. as a moderate and a liberal,
right?
Or as they see it, as an appeaser.
Right.
But that somewhere along the line, these protests were either hijacked, as they say, or a parallel protests were set up by people who started with all kinds of for what is Riyadh, rather radical anti-government statements, calling for the death of the Ayatollah, right. throwing for the overthrow of the government, and they quickly became violent. Right, again, we heard this line of peaceful protesters. And there have been, as to my count, some 21 people at least killed within the last 4 days in these protests. But if you look very carefully, you will see that the very first day there were any of these, quote, protesters, unquote, killed, they were armed and attacking military barracks and police stations to try to take them over. Mm. I mean, this is exactly what happened in Syria.
Yep. And Libya. Libya too,
and Libya as well, right? And there hasn't been any direct indication other than the regime change rhetoric flowing out of the president, the Pompeo, the director of the CIA, Nikki Haley at the Security Council, you know, openly calling basically for regime change in Iran. I want to draw your attention to a article in the New York Times. This article was from June of this year, June of 2017.
Yeah, last year, yeah.
yeah, last year. Sorry, we're already in 2018.
Yep. Amazing. Yep.
CIA, this is the actual title of the article in the New York Times. CIA names the Dark Prince to run Iran operations, signaling a tougher stance. This was on June 2nd, 2017.
Ayatollah Mike.
Ayatollah Mike is a Michael D'Andrea. He's known as the Dark Prince in the CIA. He was heavily involved in the renditions and the torture during the Bush era. He's widely expected to signal a stronger stance, a harder line, they say, more muscular approach to covert operations.
Under Pompeo,
Iran, they're complaining that Iran's intelligence services have spent nearly four decades trying to counter American espionage and covert operations. So they're putting him in. He can run a very aggressive program, but very smartly. It goes on and on here.
And this is, by the way, this president is the one who said no more regime change. People need to remind him of this constantly.
Last June, the Wall Street Journal, at the same time, also reported that the CIA had sped up a special operations cell specifically for covert operations in Iran. The Central Intelligence Agency has established an organization focused exclusively on gathering and analyzing intelligence about Iran, reflecting the Trump administration's to make that country a higher priority target for American spies, according to U.S. Officials. The Iran Mission Center will bring together analysts, operations personnel, and specialists from across the CIA to bring to bear the range of the agency's capabilities, including covert action. I don't know, but... Right. If in the last few days you have mentioned that the CIA may be involved, you know, at least exacerbating the situation on the ground, you know, even as small as it is in Iran, you were dismissed as a conspiracy theorist.
That's
why
right.
would you say it? Yeah. Right. You know, why? I mean, forget the fact that the U.S., you know, has admitted that that it helped overthrow the Shah, you know, with a CIA coup. It's kept Mossadegh and the elected socialist government of Iran and reinstall a monarch in that country, which then led to the actual blowback of the Islamic Revolution in the country. Never mind that and all the actions since then. I mean, how do you dismiss these reports? I mean, and we hear the calls, you know, for regime change and then poo-pooing any suggestion that the CIA might be involved. Please. Out of the same New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal that earlier eagerly reported that the CIA was setting up dark princes and covert operation cells against Iran.
Here today, okay, today's Voice of America News, VOA.com, VOAnews.com, Ibadi, Shirin Ibadi, who's the lawyer in exile in the UK from Iran, calling for people to stop paying electricity, water, and gas bills. They should not pay their tax. They should withdraw their money from banks. This is a call through the U.S. media to the Iranian people on what they should be doing right now. Tell me that this is not meddling. we're not talking about buying $100 worth of Facebook ads.
Meddling. Yeah. Well, we don't do that. According to the Carnegie Mellon researchers at Carnegie Mellon, only 81 times up till 2000 and not counting any regime changes or invasions and not doing anything since then.
Right.
Or not counting anything since then.
Okay.
You know, this is just incredulous. You know, the idea that the U.S. Wasn't involved. Lawfare blog, which is one of the biggest sources of the so-called resistance, published an article openly calling for terrorism in Iran to hand out improvised explosive devices, indiscriminate explosives to protesters in Iran. They openly called.
That's actually a crime against humanity to do that.
Yeah, it is actually, it is terrorism, a crime against humanity. And then they had the editors issued a response to the outcry and said simply that they wouldn't withdraw the article, that it was simply too emotional.
Right.
And didn't have legal analysis, but they were perfectly fine with the message.
We're publishing it. Thanks. All right, Mark, we're going to follow this up next week. Thanks for your time, as always.
Thanks for having me, Don. Okay. Happy New Year, everyone.
Same. Take care, brother. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.